Rick Wagner will not be here, right?
Correct.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's on.
Okay. Well, I'm opening the meeting of the House Committee on Higher Ed, Workforce Development on Wednesday, March 23rd, 2018. And delighted that you've chosen to spend your afternoon with us. Before I forget, Rep. Bynum has been excused, so we'll let her off the hook today. And I am expecting Rep. Clem. And? My pleasure to introduce a new member to our committee, Representative Leaf. And he's going to say just a couple words about himself, I hope, here in just a minute. But I got to tell you, we chattered just for a few minutes. I am just thrilled to have Rep. Leaf on this committee. And he brought his resume. And I'm telling you guys, we gotta keep up with this guy. He has, I counted him, 50 different chairs, commissions, whatever that he's been on. So he's either really active or really old. I don't know which, but
He could be both.
Welcome to the committee. Really awesome to have you with us. And if you'd like to say hello, that'd be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. You know, this is really an exciting committee. I'm grateful to be on this committee. It's something that I've been working on for really about 30 years. Just a little bit about myself. I came from a little town called Oak Ridge, Oregon, when I started school and moved to Roseburg. My father was in the timber industry and built the world's largest particle board plant back in the early 70s. I have lived in a two-mile area my whole life, pretty much. My first school was less than a mile away. My first job was a couple blocks away. My high school was less than a mile away. My first business that I started was just blocks away. We live literally a half a mile away from that. I ran a business for 40 years, and our main location was in downtown Roseburg. And then I became county commissioner several years ago, and it was literally like blocks away. So I've been very fortunate to live in an area that I love, and so I've been very giving back to the community because I felt like it was very giving to me. I was in a profession where I was able to give quite a bit of time back, and one of those was I worked with a local company, Umpqua Training and Employment, back in the early 80s for a decade, and I was past chairman of that. And we did the workforce development, I came on just as we were leaving the CETA program. I don't know if anybody remembers that. And then it went to the JETPA program, the Jobs Partnership Act, and it was a very, very great partnership with businesses. I spent a decade on that. I kind of got out of it in about 1990, but still have great relationships with that. Now I currently still work with the Umpqua Community College on workforce development, and so I'm looking very much forward to working on this committee and very grateful to be a part of it.
Well, we're very happy to have you, so please make him feel welcome. Okay. I'm opening an informational hearing to talk about the background of funding for post-secondary education. And I'd like to explain that this is really is an informational hearing. I wanted to give the public universities the opportunity to talk a little bit about their financial situation. I think we all know that obviously that tuition is an issue for our students, among other things. I want to make it clear, though, that from the beginning that my intent is not to supersede or take anything away from what the role of the HEC. The HEC is that organization that provides comprehensive budget funding recommendations and modeling. They are the ones that normally would come in and give an overview and so forth. And this is just a little bit different, but again, it's not not trying to take anything away from what the HEC does, and certainly is respect the hard work and the quality work that they do for all of our universities and colleges. So, but having said that, the idea is that we'd have, I expect that education as a whole, all P20, P-Life, whatever you want to call it, we need to have robust funding discussions coming up in 2019. My intent is to lay a little bit of the groundwork, help educate ourselves about the university systems, and in September have the same opportunity provided to the community colleges and their system. So just helping bring us up to speed to be prepared to take on this important work. So having said that, welcome Doug Wilson and Amanda Beidle. Okay. Mm-hmm. Looks like Beidle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Doug Wilson, Legislative Fiscal Office.
And I'm Amanda Beidle with the Legislative Fiscal Office.
And we'll be brief today. We were asked just to give some background of how education, specifically public universities, fits into the overall state budget. And then we'll move on to the much more jazzier presentation by the universities, other than a couple dry fiscal analysts in front of you. So
we enjoy the jazzy presentations.
So if you take a look, and this is I apologize to at least Representative Wisnett, who's probably seen these slides at least once, but they have been updated for February session, so there are some changes to them. Nothing significant, though. In terms of the total state budget, you can see that education, which is in the blue tinge, represents slightly over 50% of the budget, where it has been for the past few biennia. State school fund is much larger. You don't see that as being $8.2 billion here, because I did not include the $81 million of marijuana tax. But then you can go through that post-secondary represents about 10% of the state budget. Department of Education, other education, which includes all the grant and aids, early learning, Oregon pre-kindergarten, early childhood special ed, that portion represents about 4%, and then you could see the rest of the budget. I think it was more telling, though, is the change over time in terms of importance of what goes into the state budget in terms of general fund and lottery funds. So this dates back to the mid-80s and follows all the way through the current budget and shows what's happened in terms of the percentage shares of the general fund and then also lottery fund as those dollars came on board. And you can see really two things happening due to ballot measures. Measure 5 and their sort of companion 48 or 49, I don't remember all the numbers. You can see the red line being the state school fund just increased significantly after the passage of measure 5, and then what happened to the others. You can see that higher ed, which is the green line, did take a hit as a result of that. But also what happens here is measure 11, which dealt with sentencing in the correctional system, you'll also see the impact of that much more gradually, but you'll see that brown line, which is public safety and judicial, growing slightly. So what you see here, the winners, if you can call them that, are the state school fund and public safety. Those that lost include higher education or post-secondary education in this case, and the other areas of state government. And of course, human services is the other large component of the budget, and that history is shown there. In terms of education funding, the state school fund is by far the largest. I call this the Pac-Man graph for those that can think far enough back and remember that the video game. But then you'll see support for community colleges represents about 6%. That includes the Oregon Promise program. Support for public universities, about 10% of the full education budget. OHSU is about 1%. Oregon Opportunity Grant is about 1%. Department of Education, all those other programs, is about 8%. And then HEC, in terms of its administration and the workforce component of that department, is less than 1%. the really small components, which is the Teacher Standards Practices Commission, as well as the Chief Education Office, all represent less than 0.1%. So I did not include those in the graph because you would never be able to see it. In terms of post-secondary education, by far the largest is the public university system. The support fund, which is the main sort of block grant, for a lack of better term, to the public universities, and before that to the Oregon University System, represents about 36%. The other public university units, and these are the statewide Ag Extension, Experiment Station, Forest Research Lab, and the various statewide programs, are about 10% of the post-secondary budget. And then debt service, which you'll see later on from what Amanda is showing you, has, which has grown significantly over the past few biennia, represents a little less than, or 9%. So that's in the blue is your public university system. In the green are the community colleges, the next largest share of that, but significantly smaller. Oregon Opportunity Grant, which serves both those systems, or at least the students of those systems, I should say, represents about 7%. So again, that just shows you in the setting how much public universities and community colleges get of the roughly 50% of the state budget.
If you could pause just for a second,
sure.
Please. Rep. Wisner, you had a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wilson, you cut the dark blue, the 202.8 million other public university units. You said that's the statewide programs and what else?
It includes extension service, the experiment station, the forest research lab, and then about a little less than $40 million of a number of programs, including those that you often ask about.
The follow-up, Mr. Chair, real quick.
Yes, please.
Yeah, we're having the bill we passed on the transparency website. We're having trouble with that because I thought it was, you know, that you, there's the statewide programs, but then there's the actual agencies and things like that. So we're having difficulty knowing, you know, who's going to report, who's not going to report, and some of them are saying some of the programs they're saying are actually all nonprofit. Well, if you're nonprofit, why are you getting state money or something, or using state facilities? So that's, we're having some difficulty. I'll talk to you offline about that, but thank you.
See if we can help you out.
And could you elaborate just for a minute for the on which of those funds are going to support the operations, educational operations of the community colleges, and which is going directly to fund the universities?
So the blue-tinted ones represent the public universities, and the largest program there is the Public University Support Fund, which is a term we use, but it's the old education and general student operations. You know, it's the basic function of the public universities in terms of their teaching and administration. The other units are generally more research-based or service-based to the community in many ways. And then the other large portion there is the public, the debt service that we pay on behalf or for facilities that are financed for the public universities through the state.
And who actually receives the Oregon Promise money?
Over in the green is the community colleges. The Oregon Promise money,
they receive the checks?
I believe, and I'll let Heck,
or the,
I think, is in the room, but
students,
I believe they flow
or the students and families
to the community
it.
Colleges on behalf of the students.
Okay.
Similarly, the Oregon Opportunity Grant, I think the money flows directly to the educational institutions on behalf of the students,
yeah.
But they're connected to the students.
So it doesn't go in the family's hands.
Am I asking this question wrong, or?
No, I think you got it done.
Okay. Any other questions, or Refreshki?
Yeah, I would like to stick on the grants, the Opportunity Grant and also the Promise Grant. Do we have any metrics that tell us whether those are being effective or not, or if it would be better just to throw that money back in to lower the overall tuition for everybody?
I'll speak to the Oregon Opportunity Grant, Mr. Chair, Representative. It is based on need.
Need, right, yeah.
So if that, I mean, in terms of a measure, it's directed at a specific group of students across both community, or all three community colleges, public universities, and in some cases, private universities.
Would it be fair to say that those students would not, even if we took that money and we used it to lower tuition for everyone, those students that are targeted by that grant would not be able to make it into university or community college?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I for some share of those, I'm sure that's the case. But keep in mind, at least the public universities, within the funds that they have available, either through the state or their own other sources, also provide financial assistance. Right. And some of those students may have been able to benefit, or probably in conjunction opportunity grant, they benefit from both presently.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to turn this over to Amanda to talk about public universities and specifics.
Okay, so Chair Reardon, members of the committee, here we have the detail of the public university programs and activities that are included in the 2017-19 legislatively approved budget, including actions through the February 2018 session. As you can see, the largest share of general fund support is appropriated to the public university support fund, which Doug mentioned earlier is the state's direct investment in the operations of the public universities. HEC allocates, or the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, allocates these funds to the universities using a distribution formula that includes multiple factors such as enrollment and academic outcomes. The second largest category of general fund support is dedicated to debt service on general obligation bonds issued to fund university capital projects. The amount included in the 2017-19 budget reflects debt service on bonds issued through the end of the prior biennium, so through June 30th of 2017. The current budget, 2017-19, also includes $331.4 million of approved capital projects that will be financed through the issuance of general obligation and lottery revenue bonds during the current biennium. So repayment of those bonds that are approved this biennium will begin next biennium. And so you can expect debt service to continue to grow with just the bonds being authorized this time, estimated debt service about $50 million. The state programs line item includes a funding for a variety of institutes, centers, and programs operated by the universities. And in total, general fund and lottery fund state support represents a 14.2% increase from the prior biennium. The most significant increase in any one program being the OSU Extension Service due to the additional $24 million in dedicated lottery funds as a result of ballot measure 99. So you can go to the next one.
Which is the outdoor school.
Outdoor school, yeah. Thank you.
Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sure. Amanda, the sports lottery, so this is what we give, I think, for the athletes, right? Okay, I don't know if it ties in here or other budgets. I've been here long enough that we used to have an Oregon sports betting, and we took that off the table so we could get all these NCAA tournaments we didn't get. And now the courts have ruled that you can bet again, right? So is that, where does that money go? Does that go to the universities? Does that go to the general fund? If we go back to sports betting?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, we don't have any authorizing legislation at this point.
I mean, but where did it go before? Where did we put the general fund?
It's way before my time. It went into the lottery funds. I'm not sure if there's someone in the back of the room from the university system that were there at that time, but I'm not sure.
Maybe that I'll check.
We need to check on that.
Yeah, where it went and how much it was, I think, would be significant since I think the governor just picked up a new debt today, right, for because of the kicker.
Okay, back up, if you would, just.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So I feel like such a novice sometimes when it comes to looking at this, but if I'm looking at it, it looks like the debt service is over half of what the public university support fund is. And so this is like a more like your opinion versus the facts, maybe. I don't know. So is that significant? Is that relevant? Or what is the relevance of that? Should we worry? Something different that might be done? Just go for it.
Chair Reardon, I'll mention a couple of things. So the debt service that's in the general fund and lottery funds is supported by the state. So the state's paying back that debt service. The debt service and the other funds, non-limited, are bonds issued that are a general obligation bond of the state, so they're secured by the full faith and credit of the state, but actually repaid through university revenues. So a lot of those projects are for revenue-producing buildings, such as athletic facilities, dining facilities, housing facilities. So I don't know if comparing those types of facilities against the Public University Support Fund is...
Okay. So let me ask a question in a different way. This is really helpful. I'm just going to get calibrated here. I try not to think about this all the time. Does that level of debt service affect the cost of tuition?
Chair Reardon, I think that the state is supporting costs that would otherwise have to be incurred by the universities to do maintenance or build new buildings. So I imagine the universities would have a better idea on how much it actually reduces overall, but it is providing support to them for costs that they would incur otherwise.
Okay. All right. Thank you for your patience.
Okay. So here we have the state support levels from 1999-01 through the 2017-19 biennium. The blue section of the bar graph includes funding for the Public University Support Fund and the state programs, and then debt service is the green section. So a couple of points to highlight. First, you can see the significant decrease in the 2011-13 biennium due to the recession. Funding has returned to pre-recession levels, and if you look back just two biennia to 2013-15, the state support, excluding debt service, has increased by approximately 43%. The other point I would make is that debt service portion has been increasing significantly, yeah. And since 2013, 60% increase. And then given the level of bonding authorized for capital projects in the current biennial budget, we expect this to continue to grow moving into the 19-21 biennium.
Yeah.
All right, and so here we have the number of resident and non-resident public university students and corresponding full-time equivalents from 2007 through 2017. The resident students peaked in 2011 and has tapered off since then. However, the non-resident students has continued to grow. And as you'll see on the next slide, they have a significantly higher cost of tuition and fees, and therefore do make up an important source of revenue for the universities.
Just to point out, I think you see here in the public university system the effect of the recession, where the actual enrollment grew. If you look at community the same type of thing for community colleges with their FTE equivalent student, there was a significant increase and not then a significant decrease of students, much more predominant than what you see in public universities. But it's a different type of student on the most part too that drives that.
And then we have the average public university tuition and fees through the 2015-16 school year. Both resident and non-resident tuition and fees have increased faster than inflation. And I think to Doug's point, it's important to recognize that in the same biennium that state funding decreased significantly in 11-13 was the time when the student population increased and really caused universities to rely more on tuition and fees to cover total costs.
And finally, we'll just, I just wanted to make sure folks understood sort of the changing relationship of the public universities before the changes made in around 2012, where we went from an Oregon university system to a set of more independent public universities. As terms of a state agency, when they were part of OUS, the Oregon University System, that pre-change, they were a state agency. Their employees were state employees on the most part, and they were subject to many, if not most, of the requirements that state agencies were. After the change, as a public university, they're not state agencies in the traditional sense. There are more, the term public corporation sometimes gets used, but they're still subject to some of the requirements that state agencies have. In terms of budget requests, before, as a state agency, OUS would submit a budget to the governor and then onward to the legislature. Under the current structure, the public university budget flows through the Higher Education Commission, must be approved as part of the agency request budget with a vote of the commission itself, and then goes forward through the governor's process and into the legislative process. So they really are not the same way as a state agency, but I'm sure they won't be shy in asking for more or their fair share or whatever in the future as a public university compared to as a state agency. Employees, the state, before they were actual state employees, they're not state employees under the current system, but they are eligible and in many cases must participate in PEB, the health benefits, and they are active recipients of the PERS system to their employees. And finally, in terms of expenditure control, prior to the changes as an OUS system, they were subject to legislative expenditure control, and they were part of the accounting and budget systems. After the change, as part of public universities, they are not part of the accounting system and budgeting system, except for their general and other fund and some capital construction or debt service, just to make sure, since they were bonds issued in part by the state, they still have to run through to keep the bond councils and bond holders happy. But they are not part of the many of the expenditures, things like tuition, all the research dollars, and a number of other things are not part of the state budget or the accounting system. So, and you do not have the same level of control that you did prior to that change. I think it's important to note, because many times we'll get questions, how much are they spending in this area? And we don't have that information directly anymore to the degree we did before. And we sometimes have, you know, we must go back to them and get those that information. So with that, we'll close. Stand for any questions if you have any additional, and leave the most time for their presentation.
Question?
Yeah, real quick. Thank you, Chair Reardon. I'm not sure if this is really going to be posed as a question or something that I think that I feel like our committee may need to just talk about later. I had put in, when you talked about the bonding for the universities, I actually, we had a budget 5702 that we had voted on, and I did vote yes on that bill, but I did put in a vote explanation because I shared some great concern about our aspect of our bonding and the impact that we're kind of looking at spreading across multiple universities. And I think that we just need to make sure that we take a careful approach to that, and spoke to some of the representatives that feel that that is something that we need to make sure that we want to support our universities into the best of our ability, but there is just that concern about multiple campuses and things like that, looking at being able to support and not impact our students.
Yep. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like the last slide you had up there was employees. Between under the OUS system was state employees, and then public university says are not state employees but are participants in PERS and PEB. And I just want to understand that a little bit better. In not being state employees, what does that mean? They have separate HR and hiring practices, separate rules. And the reason I'm asking further is because PERS and PEB are two growing budget items, and so we have non-state employees in this system. I'm just trying to understand that a little better.
Mr. Chair, Representative, of course, PERS is all government, I mean, local government also, mm-hmm. school districts, yeah. cities, counties, and actually a number of other special districts and yeah. some things you'd be surprised of as PERS yeah. recipients. Part of the reason I think that they stay within those two systems specifically is the impact, if they pulled out, the financial impact on everyone else in terms, mostly for PEB, I think would be mm-hmm. the best one example. You would likely see, is what the actuaries say, that some of those, the other state agencies would see some very large increases in the medical benefit costs across the board, just because of the nature of the employees and stuff, and a larger pool. And that's one reason that they're still part of the PEP system.
I'm trying to understand a little bit more what defines a state employee and what doesn't define a state employee in your
In this case, Mr. Chair, Representative, is there, since they are no longer a state agency, they're no longer really a state employee. And there's a number of rules and compensation packages and a whole host of things that go along with that. But again, these are large institutions on the most part, and they have their own internal systems for that.
Sure. Okay, thank you.
420, right?
Mr. Chair.
So if I could just ask one question. I'm trying to wrap my heads around the support, the state support, the public universities. This was on the graph that was showed general and lottery funds. And it shows 15 to 17 and then 17 to 19. Is this a two-year or a three-year? Yeah, that one right there. Because I'm looking at this, I'm showing that it increased about 12%, looks like 850 to 960 million. Can you just explain, is that a 4% yearly increase? Is that a 12% over 2 year? Help me kind of gravitate to understand this a little bit more.
Chair Reardon and Representative, so we're looking at a two-year period because we budget we have a biennial budget, and so the blue in the 15-17, which would have been fiscal years 16 and fiscal year 17, totaled, where's my total? I have it split up, 667.3 and 39.1 million, and then in the 17-19, which would be fiscal years 18 and 19, we have 736.9 million and 46.2 million, which represents a 10.4% increase in the public university support fund and an 18.2% increase in state programs between those.
18% mm-hmm. for 2 years, okay.
Mm-hmm. There's often funding in the state program line items that's provided one time. So, for example, in the current biennial budget, we had two capital projects that were funded with general funds. So that's a one-time expenditure. Okay. It gets phased out of the next biennial budget. And then.
Okay.
And just for note's sake, the blue in here includes the general support fund and then what are referred to as statewide programs. Mm-hmm. We combined them here only because we do not have historical background going back in the early years on this graph. So, but predominantly of that blue is the public university support fund, or that general purpose block grant that is paid to universities.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right. Doug, Amanda, thank you so much for being here this afternoon. We appreciate it. And the committee, this is give us something to ponder in the months to come. So I am closing this informational session and opening an informational session on the impact of funding levels and budget requests for the 2019-2021 biennium for public universities as seen through the eyes of the public universities. So there we go. And so if those presenters, I don't know if you want to come up together and have what you have in mind, I'll let you lead. And I think we were allowing about 45 minutes or so, something like that.
45 minutes apiece? Oh, total.
Okay, Rep. Reske wants 45 minutes from each of you. I think that's what I heard. So.
Thanks, Reske.
Yeah. Wow.
Chair Reardon, members of the committee, my name is Daniel Santos, a resident of Salem, Oregon, and also proud to be a Southern Oregon alum and also a Southern Oregon Board of Trustee member. I'm here on behalf of all of the public universities, seven public universities, and we appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today about those public institutions. First and foremost, we want to say thank you for your recent investments in students and to talk about the levels of investment that we'll need in the next biennium to ensure college access for all Oregonians. Today you'll hear from myself, Brian Fox, Vice President for Finance Administration at OIT, Jesse Nelson, Associate Provost for Academic Achievement at OSU, and Ricardo Lujan Varejo with the Oregon Student Association. Before we talk about the next budget cycle, we need to take a pause and say thank you. During the last session, you increased the funding for universities by $70 million over the governor's recommended budget. In addition, while that was that increase fell short of our $100 million request, it did help us significantly reduce the cost of tuition, the increases that took place. Now, despite those recent investments, like those made last year, Oregon remains well behind our peers when it comes to funding for higher education. Now, to provide some context about that, about the numbers we're discussing today, Oregon's total higher education spending accounts for the figures that were posed before, we say 10%. I think some of the figures that we worked around would maybe move that closer to 6% of the overall state budget. We believe that we can do better, and which is what we're here about today, to talk to you and talk about those future investments. Now, over the last several decades, the average cost for providing a college degree has not risen much more than the standard inflation cost. What has changed is who's paying. In 1998, 20 years ago, students and the state split the bill about 50-50. Today, students and their families pay nearly 80% of the cost of attendance. I'd now like to turn it over to Brian Fox, Vice President for Finance and Administration at Oregon Tech, to talk a little bit more about how universities have calculated their budget requests for the upcoming biennium.
Thank you. For the record, Brian Fox, Vice President for Finance and Administration at Oregon Institute of Technology. I hope to be as jazzy as our presentation was made out to be earlier, though as the numbers guy, I tend to fail in that. Could you move to the next slide? So we come with a request, and we very much appreciate the investment that has come from this body, from the governor's office, and the attention from the HEC in investing in higher education. I think we all recognize the importance of providing post-secondary education at all levels for Oregonians. We come today and will be coming in January looking for $1 billion in investment. And I put a strong B in there as I remember back to 2006 when I was on the State Board of Higher Education listening to Kirby Dias say, we're going to go for $1 billion this go around and we're going to get it. Didn't quite happen then, but a decade later, or a little more, I think we're coming back to focus on it. And you know, I think it's important to say that $1 billion, or an increase of $268 million in the support fund, will allow most institutions to have a tuition increase at less than 3%. And though that is a large amount of money, it's kind of shocking to ask for that. It also it will provide only enough for really kind of incremental investments in students and student support, and we'll go over that in the future. We also have kind of a subsidiary request of at least $130 million in the support fund, and what that will allow is for tuition to be at or below 5% for most institutions, so you won't see kind of dramatic increases. And what that does is it actually stops the shift that that Trustee Santos was discussing earlier from the state to students. And I think that at the very least, I think we feel, and I suspect that the students, and we'll hear from that later, feel similarly, that shifting the cost and really the burden onto students back is the wrong direction for us as a state if what we want to do is have highly educated both young people for the generations that are coming up, but also returning adults. So to break down that $130 million increase in the POSF, there's sort of a couple pieces to it. And you can see the bottom two boxes here in yellow and red, the stop the shift and the business as usual. What these represent is the business as usual is really what folks would call the CSL level as it's calculated. And that is, it's what we view as, to some degree, an artificial calculation on just the state portion of it. However, we know that costs are increasing for many of the reasons that were brought up earlier, whether it's PEB, PERS, other kind of mandated cost increases, though we have some separation from the state through the governance transition. Many of the sort of cost structure pieces have not changed. We still have the same dynamics that exist for state agencies across the board. So you will be hearing in this committee and others about those dynamics. And then the $66 million, the green on top, that's reversed the shift. And what that represents is only the kind of delta, the PERS increase, that would be the student share. And we don't think that it's fair to be funding the retirement of many folks off the back of students. And we think it's very important that students be shielded from those increases. They've come for the last couple biennia. They will come for the next several biennia. I think that the PERS board forecasting the next kind of 6 years or three cycles will see that increase, but that assumes a return rate that we probably won't hit. It also assumes that there isn't a recession in that time, and we're, 7, 8, 9 years out from the last one. So at some point that will happen. And I expect that we probably will be at 10 to 12 years worth of PERS increases at the kind of 24, 25, 26% increases every other biennium. I know that represents for my institution multiple percentage, 3 to 4% of tuition increase just to deal with the PERS piece. So I think it's important that we focus on shielding our students from that. Thank you. Well, this slide isn't in my packet, so I'm going to wing it a little bit.
Sure, the best kind.
This represents and we've talked about it a little bit, the cost driver impacting the institutions. This goes back, I think, well north of a decade, and you can see where the total PERS cost at $150 million, and that was split, about one-third students, two-thirds from the state, or sorry, reverse that, one-third from the state, two-thirds from students in 2007, 2009. It's really the drastic increase in PERS expenditures, and this will continue on into the future. I mean, our projections is that we go from $150, $160 million up to $550 or $530 million by 21-23, and that split, again, shifting from about one-third of the state, two-thirds to students, to about one-fifth from the state and four-fifths from the students. And that's the kind of cost shift that we're talking about that we think has a significant and detrimental impact to our students. Next slide. And I think with that, I'll turn it over to my colleague, Mr. Nelson from Oregon State.
Thank you so much. As we arrange the microphone here, Chair Reardon, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jesse Nelson, and I serve as Associate Provost for Academic Achievement at Oregon State University. And I think my job in this presentation is to really bridge kind of the big picture piece that Brian has just presented with some student stories that we're going to hear from Ricardo. And so to do that, let me share a little bit. Certainly we know, and I think it's common knowledge at this point, that we have changing demographics in the state of Oregon. And that requires us to rethink our systems to some degree and rethink to ensure that we are delivering our services in an equitable way that's reaching all of our student populations. And as we talk then about different ways that we can do that, I want to share a little bit in regards to the support fund about four dimensions. And so this first dimension of direct service delivery that we would be providing at the universities, I want to speak a little bit about access and affordability. And when we think about access and affordability, one of the pieces that nationwide has become a trend, and certainly with us here in Oregon, is the ability to provide completion grants and emergency grants to students. We know that we have a number of students that get quite far in the process before some unexpected financial need might arise. And so completion grants are an effort to say, when a student gets to within a term or within a year of graduation, how can we provide them the financial support to actually see their task through to actual to degree. Emergency grants reflect the reality that sometimes students experience unforeseen life events, whether it be medical or health related, things related to their personal lives that might impact their ability to maintain their employment. And these things often cause significant enough distress that it leads to stop out. So with a $1 billion PUSF, Oregon universities would ensure that emergency continuation funds were established on all seven campuses. And let me just really quick highlight a couple of the things that those services would address. One would be campus vouchers for books and meals. In fact, I visited with a staff member just today who was working with a student who came into their office. This was right before I had a meeting with a staff member, and who hadn't eaten in a day. And so we find that we do have students on our campuses who are going without food, who are homeless even. So being able to have campus vouchers for things like a meal, being able to have services that provide food pantry support, housing support, can be a critical need for many of our students. And then certainly emergency loans as well. As I indicated earlier, a $130 million PUSF will allow us to continue some of the programs that we've started. The $1 billion investment allows us to expand those across our seven institutions, and as well to be more expansive in how we're able to support students. Questions on that before I move to the next slide?
Anybody else have questions?
Yes, Chair.
I'm intrigued, and I've heard your thoughts on completion scholarships and that, and all these other additional supports. So these would be additional funding required for these, right?
Correct. Yes. Okay. So for the most part, we have smaller pilot versions of these programs at many of our campuses right now.
Okay. In those pilot programs, I'm glad you have those.
Mm-hmm.
Is there evidence yet that would indicate that how these help with student retention and their ability to complete the program? Because does it really help protect our investment? You know, we already invest a lot in these students, getting them so far. Is it a matter of spending a little bit more and making sure they get over the finish line?
That's a wonderful question. So I can speak to Oregon State University. So last year we instituted we basically allocated a small amount of funds to try an emergency fund program. And we had over 150 students access those, and over 90% persisted to this year. So we found out that year-to-year continuation of over 90% was far greater than we would typically have seen.
Without lengthening the presentation too much, I shouldn't ask questions if I don't want a long presentation, but could you give examples of what type of a loan or what type of grant might be necessary, and the size of it? Just so we can get some feel for what you're really talking about.
Sure. It could be $500 to cover a dental bill that was completely unexpected, whether it be a root canal or something to that effect. But that could be funds that would be used for either daily, like living needs, or it could be for textbooks for the next term. So important to be able to continue. That would be a piece. Another element that we see sometimes is that students might be expecting a certain amount of funds from their families, wherever that they might be, whether they're local or had moved out of state. And if something happens to the parental employment, then that impacts students' ability to cover their daily needs as well. And so in some instances, it's $300 that we're putting onto a food card for the students to be able to eat on campus. So those are a couple examples.
So not to beat on this too much, but we have, I don't want to say wasted money, but if we have students that don't complete, we've made a big investment in them, mm-hmm. and they don't complete. So we're kind of protecting that investment then, is that with this? Would that be fair to say?
I think that's very fair to say. It's really for, in the big scheme of things, a smaller amount of money. So really in the hundreds of dollars for many of these students, that covers their really acute need at the time and allows them to persist.
I've heard people say, you know, it could be that car repair that puts them over the top.
And thank you, Chair Reardon, members of the committee. I just want to make a little note there at kind of the macro level and the micro level. I will say on our campus, very similarly, small dollars mean a lot for many of our students. I mean, it can be $300, maybe $1,000 to deal with those emergencies as they come up for folks who just don't have the capacity to reach those, and they end up not being able to continue their educations. I know we have, at our institution, increased the threshold at which we, or
increase the sort of the hold threshold so that students, if they owe us a little bit of money, can still register for the next series of classes so they can continue on, receive financial aid, and then we refer them to our student support folks to help make a plan to figure out how it is that they complete. The other thing that I'd like to mention, and Amanda Beidel mentioned this when she was talking about the funding distribution system for the universities, we are very different than most funding distribution systems in the state, and dare I say all, in which we have what I would call strong form accountability. Our funding is around the number of, or around the students that complete, which creates a really strong incentive for the institutions to help identify resources to help students figure out those small issues. And so, you know, along with some increased kind of operational freedom in the governance change, also came much stronger accountability for the universities where it counts, which is, are we productive in getting students not just in the door and not just butts in seats, but to completion, because we recognize that's where the value is for students. And so the bean counters like me in the back now have a really strong incentive to help folks like Dr. Nelson help students on the front end.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
Great, thank you.
Rep. Solomon, I think, has a question.
Thank you, Chair Rudin. I just like a two-part question on when you're talking about the services that you provide and help students out, which is fantastic. One question came to mind is there, now correct me if I'm wrong, is there a dedicated program? So, you know, Portland Community College has Future Connect. And when they look at the wraparound services that they provide, and then they look at the graduation rate of 70%+ of the students that actually complete. So that's a real dedicated criteria support system. So I'm wondering, when you're talking about what you're providing, do you have that type of system set up that you're looking at that? And then part two of that, so I think, because I think this all fits in, is we hear over and over again from students, the Joint Committee on Student Success, and whether we're in our districts, about students with mental health needs and social emotional supports in order to help them. We hear a lot about that in our K-12 system, but I'm just wondering, once they graduate, what kind of dedicated services are we able to provide them for higher education? Because from what I understand, some of our colleges are experiencing, you know, bulging waiting rooms, you know, waiting, you know, help, trying to help students. So it's kind of two part, because I think, you know, all those students are looking to graduate and complete. So I'm just wondering how our universities and colleges support.
Yeah. Great questions and points. So at Oregon State University, and I think that it's probably very similar to other institutions, we have what's called a Human Services Resource Center. And so that serves as our wraparound service entity to provide everything from food pantry services to support with textbook costs. And so that particular entity does collect data to see, you know, who's accessing what types of services, and what do we see as the longer term outcomes for those students that are accessing support. I don't have that data with me today, and so I hesitate to put anything out there, because I would be fearful of being wrong on that. But I'd be happy to send the committee information later. Would be happy to do that. The piece about mental health is really on point. It's a significant concern for us on the campus. In fact, our students just this year voted themselves to reallocate some of their student fees to allow us to hire additional therapists in the counseling center. Our counseling center team is certainly working to create opportunities to cast a wider net. And so that, for some students, what that looks like is, we realize that some students during the intake process would actually do well in a small group therapy setting as opposed to one-on-one. And so we are expanding those types of opportunities, with always being mindful of, if that's not the right service delivery for a student, we want to provide them access to the one-on-one. But for many, actually, especially with anxieties, that's been helpful. So I don't know that I have the magic bean to say this is how we should address the mental health situation, except to really affirm that what you've identified, it's a significant issue on college campuses.
There's still a question.
Yes.
And Rep. Alonzo Leon had a question.
Hi, thank you all for coming and sharing your presentation. One of the things that I've noticed, and having gone through the public school system and higher ed and having worked in higher ed also, is that we tend to provide a lot of, I love the focus and helping, probably undergrad. There's a lot of support system for our undergrad and not as much for our graduate students. And thinking about the services that we want to provide and all of your thinking, you know, how do you perceive allocation to funding specific for graduate students as opposed to undergrad students? Because, you know, having worked, like I said, in the higher ed system, we do put a lot of attention in making sure that our undergrad students are coming in. We either create a bridge program to help them adjust to college life, provide support services, but we tend to forget our graduate students. And so just wanted your thoughts around how this model or this funding request is going to address our graduate population.
Thank you, Representative Rubin, members of the committee. You know, I think the overall, I'm going to call it the PUSF for short, the overall support fund provides funding both for undergraduate students and to a lesser degree for graduate students. You know, each of our institutions have both varying levels and intensity of graduate students. Oregon Tech, we have really kind of applied focused master's degrees. We did not have a kind of research program or large numbers of graduate students. I think Oregon State, University of Oregon in particular, really focused in those areas. It is important, I think, for the economic development of the state to have sort of strong and robust graduate programs. They are very expensive. And part of Oregon's kind of long-term disinvestment, I think we saw it from Doug's presentation earlier, from, you know, 15 to 20% of the state budget being focused on higher education to 5 or 6% in just core operations, that hollows out your institutions, just to be totally frank on it. It hollows us out. And we are a middle tuition state and a low state support, right, which means that we're operating very, very lean as institutions. And the pieces that get cut out of that oftentimes are graduate programs, which tend not to be revenue positive. I know every time someone wants to add a master's program on my campus, I choke a little bit because they tend not to bring in revenue. They actually strengthen the core of the institution. They strengthen your undergraduate programs. So I think as we make additional investments and continue the stride that we've made over the last couple of biennia towards reinvestment in the state, that will allow us to strengthen some of those graduate programs, which we know are key to the economic development of the state.
Okay, great.
Thank you. So the next dimension that we wanted to share with you, I think I hit the forward key twice. There we go. It relates to pathways, retention, and completion. We recognize that taking a pathways approach to student persistence and ultimate success is really is bedrock to our overall student success goals. So one of the pieces that we would share is that with the $130 million increased investment, as we've talked about, our gains related to supporting student pathways to completion will be able to be sustained. In the funding scenario where $1 billion is invested, we'll really be able to serve and improve on these important goals for a future-ready Oregon. Let me share a couple examples of how that could be achieved. One is through the continuation and expansion of bridge programs. So effectively having students arrive on campus slightly before the start of fall term in order to provide really holistic support to them, whether it be curricular outside the classroom, understanding how to navigate resources on the college campus, being able to meet peers that will form a strong social network for them in their experience at the university, and then getting, again, and peer mentoring as well. You know, other ways that we can strengthen pathways relate to augmented academic programs to better meet workforce needs and accelerate pathways to graduation. We can continue to enhance academic advising to reduce time to degree to help students identify their pathways sooner. We can increase the curriculum redesign of our courses that we know maybe don't have as high of success rates. We can improve transfer articulation across the state and for our students who are moving between institutions, which is becoming increasingly common. And as an example of something at Oregon State, Let me share that we have a program called the STEM Leaders Program, which is intended to enhance the access into STEM programs of our students who are coming from underrepresented populations. And so with the STEM Leaders Program, we have a federal grant that ends in a year. It allows us to serve 60 students a year, and 95% of those students persist to the second year, as opposed to in the low 80% retention rate for our general student body. And so what we have is we've got students that are coming from underrepresented populations. That first year, we're providing faculty mentorship and undergraduate research opportunities for them that not only provide them connection to the institution, but hopefully affirm their academic identity and their sense that they can be successful at Oregon State, and then also provide them opportunities to identify career and academic goals for themselves. So that's the type of program that, with the $1 billion investment, we can create, again, a wider net to support that type of effort. Student support services clearly play a role, and I appreciate the comment about graduate student support too, and this clearly needs to be included as we talk about student support services. Again, as with a $130 million increase in the support fund, public universities will be able to maintain, but not increase, investments in proven effective support services. If the legislature decides to increase investments by the $1 billion amount, these programs could be expanded. Again, we believe that student support services directly relate to degree attainment, and that's a piece that we see. Let me share another quick campus example. We have a supplemental instruction program where we attach small study groups that are coordinated and facilitated by a student who's an upper division student who's been successful in that class. They facilitate 8-person study tables in courses that are traditionally challenging. So it might be a chemistry series or a physiology and anatomy series. And what we see from those experiences is that not only do the students do remarkably better, in fact, by almost a full grade, in that particular course when they are engaged in supplemental instruction, but that outcome then has a cumulative positive impact over time to where they'll stay at Oregon State, they'll actually reach the degree completion in a timelier manner. So again, we have what amounts to not a terribly flashy probably student support service, but it's one that we see making dramatic impact. In terms of other measures, because 80% of the university budgets are in people, many other sacrifices are made when our universities are not adequately funded. By expanding support of the support fund to $1 billion, we would all be helping the state to expand, again, statewide desires related to commercialization, entrepreneurship, research, community development, which we feel strongly helps build the Oregon economy that we're all looking for and the community that we are seeking to build here in Oregon. So that concludes my piece of the presentation to hone in a little bit, dig in from some of the big picture piece that Brian indicated earlier and how some of these play out in terms of programming at the institutions. If there aren't any other questions, we'll get to the good stuff here and talking about the student experience.
Other questions?
Okay. Wonderful again. For the record, my name is Ricardo Lujan Valerio, and I am the legislative director for the Oregon Student Association. As my colleagues have stated, the shift from the cost of education, higher education, has shifted quite significantly from a state responsibility to a student's responsibility. And so when we talk about funding and when we talk about higher education, Oregon's highest state agency in higher education, the HEC, and all of our public universities tend to have an equity lens with any kind of resource or operations that they have for students. So moving forward, I definitely would love to encourage you all to have that similar equity lens and realize some of the discrepancies that students face when pursuing higher education. You'll be able to hear some of them today. The first, one of the best things that I have within my job is that I get to travel across the state, meet great leaders, and kind of hear some of the things that they experience as students, and specifically the ones that you're going to be hearing about today, they're student leaders. They're all either current student body presidents or elected student body presidents that will be going on for the following year. And the first person that I want to talk to you about is Daisy Bedoya. Daisy is an Eastern Oregon University student and a two-time student body president at the university. As a student leader, she's done multiple things, including going to Washington, D.C. to advocate for Dreamers, and within our state, help us within multiple work groups alongside OSA, one of them being House Bill 2998, Credit Transferability Work Group. And she's been able to give a perspective about a rural perception on credit transferability. So she's been a great leader within her peers and her community, and a kind of a beacon of leadership for many of those that are under very peculiar circumstances that find challenges in higher education. Unlike many students, Daisy does not qualify for a lot of the federal financial aid affordabilities that others might, which limits her financial ability to afford college. Thanks to the tuition equity work that we've done in the state, some of that financial burden is lower, but still significantly high. For that reason, tuition discussions are very important to Daisy and students like Daisy, because it can mean the difference between affording one term's tuition and not the next one's. So the decisions that you make in this body truly make a difference on whether a student can come up and go to higher education or not.
I actually had the pleasure of meeting Daisy.
That's right.
Last October when my wife and I visited Eastern, and incredible young lady with an incredible story. So you're getting about half the impact of what she did, but good job.
She's been a great student, Chair Reardon, and she's one where even within our spaces she challenges us to be better, and so it's just one example of how leadership within our institutions are, you know, they flourish within these environments, and we can uplift those voices. And the dollars that we put into the institutions, they're not investments necessarily to the institutions, but investments to the students. And this is the outcome that you'll get. The second student that I want to talk to you about is not Donald, unfortunately, but Evelyn Guzman. Evelyn Guzman is going into her last year at Western Oregon University and is selected to be the new student body president. She is a outstanding student throughout this year. She was a vice president when she worked on tuition equity this past year, and also traveled, like Daisy, to Washington, D.C. to advocate for students' rights, and specifically those of Dreamers. One of the biggest concerns that she has in terms of tuition affordability is that although she is a citizen, she does qualify for a lot of the different programs that DC couldn't qualify for. But being part of a minority community, she recognizes some of those discrepancies that her family and her peers face. So when it comes to the affordability aspect, she's thankful of what's been afforded to her thus far through the institution. But there's still a lot of gaps that need to be met by the state. She is a major in business, and she's not sure about what she wants to do post-graduation, but she does know that she wants to stay within Oregon and work for a nonprofit to better the lives of her community there. The next student that we'll talk about is Daryl Mapplethorpe, and she is the person in the right of the picture. She's the current student body president at Southern Oregon University, and she is going into a graduate program at Lewis and Clark for psychology. She, like Evelyn, is well qualified for a lot of institutional financial aid and federal financial aid, but the tuition increases definitely burden her to a pretty high level, where she's going to actually come out of Southern Oregon with $15,000 worth of debt. That's a very significant number, especially for someone that's looking into going to a graduate program, right? So we want to make sure that when we're talking about these students and we uplift their stories, that we have that equity lens perspective on these, right? And some of the work that Daryl Mapplethorpe has been able to do as a student is testify in front of y'all in regards to the tuition discussions that have happened, testify in front of the HEC about tuition increases, and continue to show the student representation within her own institution. Now, there might be something that you all might have noticed in terms of all these stories, which is the very apparent success that these students have, whether they're pursuing higher education post-graduate or if they're just not unsure. But one thing that I've gained, that I know from all these individuals, is that regardless of what they do afterwards, they want to do it in Oregon. And when we're talking about the economic investment for Oregon and what economically we should be working towards, we should retain all the work that we're doing with these students in our public institutions. We want to make sure that these folks stay home and contribute to our economy. And that's a clear example of how these folks are pursuing that and wanting to contribute to their community. So I do respectfully request that you take the $1 billion, I know it's a big number, but the $1 billion request very close to you, because it uplifts stories like this, and it provides services to students like this. Again, don't look at this as an investment to the institution. Look at this as an investment to Oregon's future. Because the less we invest into this, the more we'll see people going out of state, and the more we'll see our economic infrastructure crumble. So I thank you for your time, and I'm sure we'll be available for some questions.
Other questions? Just one kind of general... several, but one I was thinking about is the as the economy changes, how much flexibility, I guess, Brian, this might be for you, is how much flexibility is there in your budgeting? I know a high percentage of your costs must be employee-driven. A lot of those are tenured folks. I mean, how does that, can you give us just kind of a general idea of how that works? And
yeah, Representative Reardon, members of the committee, I'll say that is the question that keeps me up at night. If we went back to some of the slides that LFO showed earlier, there was a drastic decline in the 2010-11 range. You know, for an institution like ours, that the smaller institutions tend to have a larger proportion of our budget tied to state funding. You know, if we see a 10 or 15% decline, or a, you know, even 30% decline as came through that year, in state funding, that can translate into 7, 8, 9% of our budget, which may not sound huge, but when 85% of your budget are personnel, many of those are tenure track faculty, the what I'd call kind of the duration risk that we have, we really can't variabilize that for several years, right? And you go through a program reduction elimination process, it would take a couple of years before you start realizing savings. It's also important to note that realizing savings are less jobs. There really aren't other places to cut in our institutions. We are very, very lean, particularly as we compare to our peers. And so if you start losing positions, you start losing faculty who are teaching courses needed for folks to graduate. So you end up actually lengthening the time for students in programs. And I think we're all focused on the opposite of that, actually accelerating the time to completion. You end up losing folks who are frontline, you know, people call them administrators, and so they talk about administrative bloat, but much of the addition of the institutions are really administrators focused on student support. So you end up drawing some of the, you know, kind of the ranks in those down, or reducing completion grants, those sort of pieces that have, unfortunately, pretty direct and significant impact. So it both takes time to adjust, which is really hard on the institutions, many of which don't have the kind of strong balance sheets in order to withstand that. And then two, any of those reductions tend to have very direct and meaningful impact on students, and particularly those students that are low-income, first-generation students of color, rural students, those folks who need more kind of hands-on touch and help. Those are the folks who get impacted the most. And, you know, we try our best to shield that, but it's difficult.
Good. Representative Leon.
Thank you. So having worked in higher ed before, as specifically working in, I ran a national scholarship program, College Assistance Migrant Program for PCC. And so that allowed me to develop programming to help with retention. And I absolutely support the importance of having student support programs. Completely, I am with you, and I'll be your champion on that side. And I wonder what kind of federal programs we have to help with retention programs that could supplement state funding, and I wonder what you all have researched on, or what is out there, you know, just to make sure that that we have that support happening in addition to what can be requested of the state.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. We do quite a bit to stay active with that, and I also have worked for many, many years with the CAMP program, and so I say thank you to you. What a tremendous program the College Assistance Migrant Program is. And so we work, as an example, at Oregon State. We are consistently working with the Department of Education related to both Office of Migrant Education grants and TRIO funded grants. And so we are active every year looking either to renew current grants or to expand our grant funding with some of those programs. We also currently work with First in the World grants at the federal level. We have a significant number of NSF grants that support both access into STEM disciplines and then support through their STEM experience. So I think your point and question is a great one. We certainly need to be working in collaboration with federal opportunities, and that's something that we do take very seriously.
And if I could just add to that, Chair, I think also partnering with agencies in applying for additional funding, because as we know, when you're working in partnership with other organizations, the likelihood of you getting funding is a lot higher because you're working in partnership as opposed to applying independently. That's just my MPA background right there.
That's great.
Chair Reardon. Vice Chair Alonso de Leon, I just also want to comment that in addition to some of these other programs from the federal side, clearly we have the veterans, that we have programs that not just tuition assistance, but a lot of help on some of the mental health issues, a wide range of other things, so we leverage that as well. But you also point out the partnerships we need to develop, and some of the examples cited earlier, the Raiders to Bulldogs, I mean the Bulldogs to Raiders, the Pirates to Raiders, are pipeline programs that we work with school districts on to try to get underrepresented students into more prepared, not just to graduate from high school, but to move on to a post-secondary opportunity and better prepare them for those types so that we have a better graduation rate for those students. But clearly, having worked in state government for a long period of time, it's this partnerships that we have to have with state agencies, local and nonprofit, that will leverage those resources for greater success for our students and their families.
Yeah. And if I may add as well, Chair Reardon, Vice Chair Alonso Leon, when it comes to programs that include, you know, the retention aspect of students, students are also attracted to what kind of benefits and resources are available to them, whether it's the Women's Resource Center, Multicultural Resource Center, Mental Health Resource Centers. And as you've heard earlier today, we even go as far, students go as far to make their own money allocations to support these resources. It's not just with the Mental Health Resource Centers. You know, when I was a student in student government as well, we've made decisions where we would allocate nearly $1 million to support these services. And so aside from even the tuition costs that go into higher education, students are then realizing how important these services are to them and to their peers to go as far and give additional money to it. So I think that being able to stand with those students as well and provide additional funding to lower that burden on some of the great services that are provided would be a great statement from the Assembly to the future of Oregon.
Okay. Well, if there are any other questions, Ripley.
So thank you, Representative Leon. I think the retention is a really important part of this. When I look at this budget, the $1 billion, that's about a 26% increase if I do my math right. And I think I heard in there was about a 70% rate moving on forward or graduation, I guess. Is that close to the number, 70%?
Chair Reardon, members of the committee. Institutions vary pretty significantly. So
on average,
year-to-year retention can be as high as 90% of some institutions that cater towards higher-income folks. Those institutions that tend to focus on lower-income minority students, it tends to be lower, which is the problem, I would even say.
So I guess my question was, with this 26% increase, have you quantified where you might be with the percentages that would be able to be successful? You understand my question, right?
Yeah, absolutely, Chair and members of the committee. So we have not, it's hard to pay kind of a dollar in equals, give us $100, it's a 1% increase. It's really hard to get to that tight of a relationship. The other component is it takes time to scale these up. So, I don't want this to be like the wiggle, well, give us more money, we'll figure it out. It actually takes time to scale these programs up, make them sustainable, learn lessons where you get small grants or partnerships with other folks, and then implement them. I do think sustained investment over time can yield pretty significant increases. And obviously, for our institution, we institute a program, The ROC. I'm not sure what it's an acronym. I'm not sure for what, but we, somebody's kicking me at home for that. That said, we increased dramatically within a year. We tripled the number of staff that were focused on student support. And within a year of doing so, we saw an increase of 4 or 5% in retention rates, which, again, 4 or 5% doesn't sound huge, but that's just in 1 year. And we expect over time that that will increase pretty significantly. And that's focused on first-time freshmen as they come in. With additional resources, we can start focusing that on transfer students. We can do that for more than just 1 year. So what we've done, triaging, is to say, okay, we're going to focus just as first-time freshmen come in. And with that, we're able to increase pretty significantly immediately. We expect that that will continue to grow as we hone in, as we get better, but that requires consistent investment over time. And I think the fear on the institution side, at least for me, is that, you know, one-time increases are great, but if those are followed pretty quickly with decreases or even with flat funding, when we start seeing large increases in PERS and PEB, those sort of things, it becomes hard to sustain. So I can't give you a quick kind of quid pro quo there, but I can say that we are focused on investing in the programs that most directly serve students, and that over time will yield, I think, pretty significant impacts in retention and importantly, completion.
So, Mr. Chair, if I could just add, so for me, seeing a 26% increase, I would think that a goal of something would be really important for me to see. I'm just saying that that's a significant increase. So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Chairman, if I may, as a response to this question,
please.
I think each of our institutions are at different places in strategic planning, too. And I know that President Ray at Oregon State University has challenged us to say, what is it going to take for Oregon State to get to a 70% graduation rate? So right now we sit at about 65%. So that 5% graduation rate is using federal nomenclature, which is a six-year rate, which to many of us seems a little strange that we would use 6 years as the measurement for that, but that's typical across the country. The piece that I want to highlight is that this $1 billion investment not only helps us improve the overall graduation rate, but this time to degree component is really critical. We can reduce the overall debt load on students by providing them a more efficient experience through their curriculum to degree. And so if we can not only raise overall graduation rate to 70%, but increase that 4 and 5 year graduation rate so that students are leaving in a more timely manner, that has a tremendous impact, certainly in individual and family lives, but I think also in really spearheading the economic development we're talking about.
Okay. That's a really challenging question, and we did have some presentations. I think they were from HEC in the beginning of 2017, so maybe we can find those, and anybody else would want to review those, but maybe we can make those available to you. Help you find those, but it's not a simple question to how do you measure success
and 26% isn't
but
simple.
I get that too. Okay. So
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Rep. Solomon, are you going to wrap up? Last question of the day.
I am. Why? Thank you, Chair Reardon. I was just excited about that comment that you had just made too, because I wondered, like, when we're talking about investments and we're looking at partnerships and things, that how we can best look at. Chair Reardon and I put the bill forward for credit, accelerated credit and dual credit options. So, you know, how we can build upon those type of programs to really help speed the process for students to graduate and to go in with less, you know, out the door with less college debt.
Yes.
So I would be interested to, you know, especially here, maybe not now, but how that's going to work, you know, for our universities to build that program. And
Well, to be honest, I was all ready to wrap it up. I thought you were at the end. I was just reminded that you have
two slides left, so there you go.
Yeah. Next.
Kind of the process here, so we'll be very quick on the slides.
Next.
Oh, really? Oh,
there we go.
And this is really a statement from the Register Guard that I think we all agree on, that one of the best investments that we as a state can make, both in the lives of Oregonians and in the economy of our state, is to make investments in higher ed. So thank you very much for your time.
Well, I'd like to thank all of you for being here today, for your commitment to give us a chance to start thinking early about this process. I'd like to thank the committee for your questions, and then once again encourage you to visit that university so you can meet the Daisies and other kids that are out there. They're the reasons that we're here, I think. If you have questions, concepts, any ideas, anything we need to be thinking about as a committee, please funnel those to Alethea. She is eagerly waiting to hear from you. Okay? All right. Thank you all. It's been wonderful.
Thank you.
Oh.